Lapse of Time. This week, as motion picture goers throughout the country are seeing, hearing about, talking about the new February issue of The March of Time on the screen, inside Nazi Germany, 1938, in Chicago and Washington, in New York, Philadelphia, New Orleans, San Francisco, it has been the subject of front page news stories as well as columns of comments and editorials. For this new issue of The March of Time, the first uncensored film brought out of Nazi Germany in 5 years, presents pictorially a subject of immediate and intense U.S. interest and of great historical implication. The effects on the German people of 5 years of Adolf Hitler's rule. After a special Washington preview for prominent congressmen and government officials, said Senator Key Pittman, chairman of the Senate Foreign Relations Committee,
"Inside Nazi Germany shows exactly what happens when a dictator takes control of a nation. I think it highly desirable that this picture be seen by every American."
In New York, says Guy Emery Shipler, editor of the Churchman,
"Inside Nazi Germany, 1938, ought to have a profound effect on American thought. It's very restraint in dealing with the situation so completely lacking in restraint adds notably to the strength of the presentation."
Says columnist Dorothy Thompson,
"The tempest raging around the March of Time's film, Inside Nazi Germany, 1938, raises not only the question of screen censorship, but also whether a motion picture can or should deal with an important controversial subject. It's a highly exciting picture, a realistic portrayal of Germany today, and a magnificent piece of journalism. Who on earth can doubt the right or the reason for presenting such a motion picture document?"
This new issue of The March of Time, which is entirely devoted to the single subject of Nazi Germany, will be shown in more than 11,000 motion picture theaters throughout the world. We suggest you phone the manager of your local theater and ask him when he will play this latest March of Time on the screen. Inside Nazi Germany, 1938.
Tonight, Life, the weekly magazine of pictures, and Time, the weekly news magazine, who join in producing The March of Time on the screen every month, now present by radio the reenactment of memorable scenes from the news of the week.
From The March of Time. Washington, D.C. One day early in the year 1934, lunching with a friend in an unpretentious Washington cafe is a clerk from the Department of Interior, one Reno Stitely.
"What are you looking so sore about, Reno?"
"Oh, why not? We're making out checks for CCC camp supervisors all morning. $4 million worth, and me with only 15 cents for lunch."
"You send out payroll checks from Washington for all those CCC camps?"
"You bet I do. I practically run that interior department. If it wasn't for me, listen, those big shots up there don't know where the money goes or who gets it or how much. They don't know anything."
"You mean they don't check up on the money?"
"Check up? Why, a smart guy could go in there and pad those payrolls, make out checks to phony names. Well, he could make up a whole phony CCC camp with a phony supervisor. They'd never know. They'd..."
"Gee, somebody's sure gonna swindle them up there someday."
"Yeah, somebody sure is. Somebody sure is."
Next day, in an office of the Department of Interior.
"You got time to okay these CCC camp requisitions, Chief?"
Sure. "Syracuse, Mobile, Shenandoah National Park, camp number 357. Initial cost $6,000.
"Yeah, that's a new one. Just started."
"Ah, yeah. Supervisor, Lieutenant J. Feldheimer."
"He's a good man, Chief. They transferred him from reclamation down in Florida. A very good man."
"Yeah, well, okay, Stitely. Make out checks right away."
"Yes, sir, right away."
Then, month after month, through the check-writing machine of the Department of Interior,
"A check to J. Feldheimer, Camp 357, Shenandoah National Park. $594.62 for barbed wire, tar paper roofing, grass seed, garden."
"A check to J. Feldheimer, Camp 357, for $2,500. Construction Shenandoah Park Camp new bunkhouse with steam heat."
"A check to J. Feldheimer, Camp 357, for $520. Personal salary increase for excellent work in developing Shenandoah Park season."
4 years and 1,116 checks later, in an office of the Department of Interior, a detective talks to a department head.
Say, Chief, you got a minute to talk to me?"
"I'm awfully busy.
But, Chief, you ought to see this. It's about CCC Camp 357. You know, I just been on a tour of inspection.
Well, 357, that's Shenandoah Park.
Yeah.
Got the records right here, Lieutenant Feldheimer's camp.
Well, yeah.
Built up quite a project down there. Only spent $84,000 in 4 years.
But, Chief, when I was down there, I couldn't find this guy, Feldheimer.
Yeah, well, he was on the sick list for a while. You try the camp hospital?
Well, I couldn't find the camp hospital either. There ain't any.
No camp hospital?
Well, Chief, there's no camp.
No camp?
No, sir, no camp.
Listen, Kelly. Go up to the accounting department in this building. There's a man there named Stitely. Reno Stitely. Go and find him. Get him down here. Arrest him. Throw him in jail.
This week, sentenced to 6 years in prison is Clerk Reno Stitely for swindling the U.S. government to the tune of $84,000. And this week, with the discovery of the first imaginary CCC camp in New Deal history, a camp which existed for 4 years on the records of the U.S. Department of Interior, cracked wide open as a grade-A scandal. As further investigation discloses that a total of $1.5 million in CCC expenditures is to date unaccounted for, the Department of Interior bookkeeping is still a year behind schedule, that $1 million was spent to maintain a Department of Interior secret detective force, that department detectives tapped telephone wires and spied on virtually every federal employee in Washington except Franklin D. Roosevelt and government clerk Reno Stitely. Time marches on. In a doctor's office in Miami, Florida, one day this week, a physician completes the examination of a patient, 37-year-old Dr. Florence Tuttle.
Well, Dr. Tuttle, you want me to speak frankly?
Yes.
Chances are you'll be dead within a month.
Yes, that's what I thought myself, but I had to have another opinion to be sure.
I'm sorry.
Oh, it's not for myself. It's my little girl I'm really thinking about.
Barbara?
Yes, tuberculosis of the kidney. She may live as long as 2 years.
Yes, she may.
Oh, I know it's a terrible thing to say, a terrible thing to think, but I'd always hoped, as long as things had to be this way, that Barbara could go before I did. There'd be no one to take care of her, no relative. I have no money. It's a terrifying thought, a child dying alone in some institution.
Well, Dr. Tuttle, I'm sure you can make some provision.
Yes. Yes, I'll have to make some provision soon.
Next evening, in a Miami hotel apartment, Dr. Tuttle finishes writing a note.
Barbara, are you all ready for bed?
All ready. Aren't you coming, too?
In a minute.
Who are you writing to, Mother? Let me see.
No, get away.
Mama.
Oh, I'm sorry I spoke sharply. I'm sorry, dear. I'm all through writing now. Barbara.
Yes, Mother.
Here, sit on my lap, and I'll tell you a story.
Oh, Mama, take your hanky away from my nose. It smells funny. Sweet.
I know, dear. But breathe. That's right. The stuff on the handkerchief will help you to go to sleep.
Uh-huh.
Yes, dear. Breathe deeply. Once upon a time, there was a little girl. A very good little girl. And she always liked to hear stories.
This week, 9-year-old Barbara Tuttle is the year 1938's first victim of mercy murder. This week, Dr. Florence Tuttle, near death from self-administered poison, is placed under indictment for the murder of her 9-year-old daughter. And this week has announced the formation of a society in the U.S. to legalize mercy murder, known as euthanasia. Says president of the American Euthanasia Society, Dr. Francis Potter.
In the Nebraska legislature last year, a bill to legalize mercy murder was defeated. This year, we intend to introduce euthanasia bills in the Ohio and New York legislatures and into the United States Congress. When a mercy murder bill becomes a law, as we firmly believe it will, a woman like Dr. Tuttle could not be held for mercifully taking the life of her child to shield it from physical and mental suffering.
Time marches on. Hayward, California. Just before dawn in the cow barn of the Hanson Orloff Dairy Ranch near the small city of Hayward, 3 miles from San Francisco Bay, two farmhands walk up and down the long line of stalls using a flashlight to inspect the cows.
Nothing wrong with these cows. I'm certain that I heard one of them bellowing. She sounded like she was dying.
Well, they're all perfectly healthy now.
Listen.
That's what I heard. Yeah, but it's no cow, is it?
Sounds like it's right outside the barn. Go and look. I'll close up here.
No, you look. Listen. Something's scraping at that open door back of us. Flash the lantern there, Bill.
Mm-hmm. Well, what is it?
Well, it's a seal.
It's a seal, all right. Out in the cow yard.
We ought to get it back to the ocean, I suppose. The
ocean's 3 miles away. Say, listen, we better call up the game warden or somebody. Somebody that knows something about seals.
Later, a puzzled game warden arrives at the Hanson Orloff Dairy Ranch. But already up and down the countryside, the story spreads. A Pacific Ocean seal has come to Hayward, California, in the office of the mayor.
Oh, why didn't somebody tell me about this sooner?
You ought to see, Your Honor. The crowd down there is blocking traffic.
Of course it is. This seal can put the town of Hayward on the map. Has anybody called the San Francisco papers?
I don't think so.
Well, call them, all of them. And somebody go down and tell the game warden to keep that seal moving right along the main highway.
Okay.
I'll be down later. I want to get a police escort down there for that seal right away.
In 1 hour, Hayward's seal has flipped along 1 mile of its 3 miles back toward San Francisco Bay, followed by a crowd of some 1,000 Hayward citizens. In the local office of the Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals...
Madam, the SPCA is trying to get the seal back to the ocean. They haven't put him in a truck because he won't get into a truck. Yes? Our man is down there now. But we don't have any regulations covering seals. I can assure you that that seal is getting every protection the SPCA can afford.
2 hours later, the Hayward seal is half a mile from San Francisco Bay. And in a bungalow in Hayward's residential section...
Oh, Mildred, can't you get into that uniform any faster?
I'm hurrying as fast as I can.
I don't know why we didn't hear about this before. With a thing like this happening in Hayward, it'll look mighty funny if we're not there with the ladies' auxiliary band.
Hours later, and Hayward's seal is a scant 100 yards from the waters of San Francisco Bay, slipping its way through a crowd of some 3,000 lining the shore.
Ladies and gentlemen, I've been asked to announce that the fish fed to the seal on his heroic journey was furnished with the compliments of Breen's Fish Market.
All right now. Stand back, please. This seal is in a very exhausted condition. The SPCA is officially in charge here.
Popcorn, fresh roast, and hot.
All right, girls. They're all hot. California, here I come. 1, 2.
To the strains of Hayward's town band and ladies' drum corps, to the cheers of hundreds of citizens and farmers from the surrounding countryside, an 8-foot-long bull seal, whose presence inland is still a mystery, wades into San Francisco Bay, having consumed 8 pounds of fish, 64 hot dogs, flipped himself 3 miles in 3 1/4 hours to establish an official record for land-going seals, an unofficial holiday in the city of Hayward, California. 1938 marches on.
Thank you.
the newly won loyalist city of Teruel, one day this week, an American knocks at the door of a working-class woman, Carmen Martinet Piedra.
Good day. What do you wish?
Senora, I'm trying to find out what went on in Teruel during the 18 months of rebel rule. Can you tell me...
No, senor. I can tell you nothing. I know nothing at all.
Well, I had heard there were some executions. I thought that...
Senor, who are you?
I'm an American newspaper man. Lawrence Burnsworth, New York Times.
Come in. Quickly. I will not speak of anything I did not actually see with my own eyes. But I can tell you a little. Sit down.
Thank you.
This is what I know myself. It was one day early in the rebel occupation, a Sunday. My brother Manuel had an insurance office and had gone to work that morning. When I was cooking dinner, I sent my little girl to the store to buy chocolate. She came back and told me she couldn't go to the store because they wouldn't let anyone through the plaza.
This little girl here?
Si, Conchita. So I went down. And I saw my brother there with his hands in chains. The plaza was decorated. There were a great many people. Then the soldiers shot him and the others. Crowds in the square and in balconies applauded. When it was over, a band marched past the bodies, playing. At night, there were feasts and dancing in the plaza. I can tell you that much, senor, for I saw it with my own eyes. But after that, I shut myself in my house and never went out again.
This week, as it is estimated, 3,000 persons, one-fourth the city's population, were executed in the Teruel Terror. As 400 rebel planes battle to regain the city, in France declares U.S. Ambassador William C. Bullitt,
there are murderers at large who take pleasure in dropping bombs on helpless men. Their return to sanity may be long delayed. New religions have been invented that deny our belief in the dignity of human personality. New religions that ask us to believe the highest destiny of man is to live and to act under a supreme trainer like animals in a circus.
This week, in many a nation of the world, dictators crack their whips, define the creeds and rituals of many a new nationalist religion.
Soviet Russia this week.
In the Hall of St. Andrew in the great Kremlin Palace, the new Council of the Union is in session.
By order of Stalin, Comrade Rychkov is nominated to replace Comrade Krylenko on the Council of Commissars. Unanimously elected, Comrade Voyeznensky replaces Comrade Valery Mashlov. Unanimously elected, Comrade Kaftanov replaces Comrade Ivan Meshlov.
Comrade... 17 new Russian commissars are elected this week to replace those purged in the past year. As the new Soviet Congress adjourns, without passing or submitting a single law, voting unanimously on every order of Comrade Joseph Stalin. In Romania this week, new fascist dictator Octavian Goga plans expulsion of 500,000 Jews, the calling of a world anti-Jewish Congress, aligns himself with Germany's Adolf Hitler and Italy's Benito Mussolini. And this week in Japan, heard from is one who by this week of 1938 has extended his spiritual rule to the status of another of the world's dictatorships, God Emperor Hirohito, in a classical Japanese poem.
Peaceful is morning in the shrine garden. World conditions, it is hoped, also will be peaceful.
Time marches on. Newark Airport, 8:30 one night this week.
Flight 85, direct to Washington, Eastern Airlines, ready to take off. Flight 85, taking non-passengers. Check your ticket to the gate, please.
I expect so.
right in, Sergeant.
What time are we doing Washington, Porter?
About an hour and 20 minutes. All right. Everybody's aboard.
Flight 85, Newark to Washington, taking off.
As Flight 85 takes off into a clear sky from Newark Airport, high over the Atlantic Ocean, a great current of air is circling slowly around the high-pressure center. Over the eastern United States, a low-pressure area with its encircling winds is moving toward the sea. Closer and closer, the two tremendous air currents approach. 20 minutes later, off Cape Hatteras, they meet. Fuse into a mighty blast of air that roars up the Atlantic seaboard with gale force, uprooting trees, leveling telephone wires, sweeping northward through the night at 90 miles an hour. Cabin of Eastern Airlines, Flight 85, a half hour at Newark.
Flight 85 calling Newark. Come in, please.
Go ahead, Flight 85.
Bucking 80 mile an hour headwind, rain, no visibility. Returning to Newark. Come in.
Okay, Flight 85. We'll be expecting you. Keep in touch with us. Newark 5.
Okay, Fred.
Jim, Bean's gone.
Gone? How are we going to find Newark?
I don't know, Jim. I don't know.
An hour and a half later at Newark Airport. It is 10:30 o'clock.
Newark Airport.
Hello, Newark. This is Washington. Flight 85 is a half hour overdue here.
Yeah, she turned back at Camden an hour ago. Meant she lost the beam. We're trying to contact her now.
What are you here?
Nothing. Nothing for the last hour. We don't know where she is. Nobody knows where she is.
Hour after midnight, over station WOR in Newark.
Ladies and gentlemen, we are interrupting this program for an important announcement. An Eastern Airlines transport is up in the air somewhere here in the east, lost. Their gas won't hold out much longer. If any of our listeners hear the sound of an airplane motor, please notify this station at once.
One o'clock at Newark Airport.
Got anything?
Shh, listen.
85, calling Newark. Come in, please.
Go ahead, Flight 85. Go ahead.
Must be north of you somewhere. Can't find me. Can you locate us? Go ahead.
Yes, Flight 85. Keep calling. We'll try and locate you. Go ahead.
Yes, running low. Can't hold out much longer. Please hurry it.
Gone again.
Another hour goes by. In the cabin of Flight 85, the two passengers, shoe merchant C.C. Bain and government clerk Philip King, sit tensely waiting as the fifth hour of their flight creeps slowly by.
What time do you suppose it is?
I don't know.
No, don't look.
Yeah, better not.
It must be way past 1 o'clock, though. It must be almost out of gas.
We might ask the pilot.
No, he's busy.
Yeah, that's right.
You got a pencil?
Sure.
There's nothing else to do. Thought I might write a little note.
I wrote one about half an hour ago myself.
Yeah? Where'd you put it?
In my vest pocket.
Got a metal cigarette case?
That's an idea. That won't burn. I'll put it in my cigarette case.
It is 3 minutes of three. In the pilot's cabin of Flight 85...
Flight 85 calling Newark. Flight 85 calling Newark.
Keep trying, Jim. Don't have much more time.
How much?
Gas for 10 minutes, maybe.
Newark calling Flight 85.
Fred, I got him. Flight 85. Come in, Newark.
Listen, Flight 85. We've got you located. You're right near Hartford Airport.
Hartford.
Come down to 500 feet. Low terrain. Swampy.
Get it, Fred?
Right.
Watch the wind direction, Newark.
Wind reported south 18. Estimate direction to 13.
There's the field lights, Jim, over there.
Okay, Newark. We're going to try to land now.
Okay, Jim. Flaps down.
Flaps down.
You want to cut the motors. Can't see the ground, just lights. Here we go.
400 feet. 360. 300, Fred.
We're doing okay.
210. her straight on. 100. 50. 30. 12, Fred. 10. Hello, Newark. We're on the ground.
This week, in a flight unique in U.S. aviation history, a giant Douglas transport plane is blown helplessly on a 1,000-mile journey over an area comprising 5 states. Lands finally at Hartford, Connecticut, with 100 miles north of where it started, with less than 10 minutes' supply of gasoline left in her tanks. Time marches on. Washington, D.C. In the Antoine shop at Garfinkel's, fashionable Washington department store, a woman customer one day this week sits in a barber's chair.
I don't know. And do you really think I've got the right shape face for it?
There is a different type of bob for every face, Mrs. Roosevelt. It does not have to be extreme.
Does your family disapprove?
Oh, no. At least I don't think so.
Please, let me try it, yes?
Well... Oh, wait, I never thought. All my hats will be wrong. They'll waggle around on my head.
Then for now, we cut only the sides. Then when Mrs. Roosevelt's ready to buy spring hats, we cut off the back, too.
Shall I, Mrs. Roosevelt?
Well...
This is our Jeanette.
All right. Go ahead. Cut it off. Oh, I wonder what my family will say.
First to consider breaking a conservative precedent of White House wives was Grace Coolidge, who wanted bobbed hair. Never got it because her son John objected. But this week, the first lady in U.S. history to wear bobbed hair in the White House is Anna Eleanor Roosevelt.
I suppose every woman feels it's one of the great decisions of her life when she cuts off her long hair. That last night at a White House reception... The president was much amused, and I was a little chagrined that not one of the guests noticed I'd bobbed my hair.
Time marches on. The pageant of the week's news. Memorable scenes from the news of the world you have followed tonight on the March of Time. It is this great news pageant of the world the magazine Life is unfolding every week before the eyes of its readers in pictures. The new issue of Life is on sale at newsstands tomorrow morning. In this issue, you will find...
stories from the week's news front.
Only with pictures could the news story of the progress of 1939 New York World's Fair be told. Pictures of the 9 huge, spectacular buildings already up, and of the even more exciting buildings under construction. And only pictures could tell the story of the flaming oil well in the heart of the city of Kilgore, Texas. Of the sudden discovery of sex appeal by aristocratic old Palm Beach, Florida.
Life, the camera overseas.
Pictures of the new German Zeppelin being built to replace the Hindenburg, and of U.S. helium factories which are shipping precious non-explosive gas for the Zeppelin. Pictures from tragic Teruel, Spain, which show the true aspect of this new battleground of the Spanish War.
Life, sport.
A complete picture documentation of a boxer's life on the day of a fight. 35 pictures of 12 tense hours in featherweight champion Henry Armstrong's life, from rising in the morning to knockout at 9 that night.
Life's photographic essay of the week. The life of a student nurse.
Pictures of what a nurse's life is like. As she studies, works, has fun, learns to care for the sick.
Life's movie of the week. The March of Time's latest issue, Inside Nazi Germany, 1938.
Pictures from the uncensored film, showing what life in Germany is today. For working men, for their wives, for their children. Regimentation, sacrifices for the greatest war machine in the world today.
These are but 5 of the 50 stories in pictures with which Life covers the world this week in its new issue.
News dealers have still another 100,000 additional copies of Life. But many newsstands will be sold out by tomorrow night. So to make sure of getting your copy, we suggest you ask your news dealer for Life tomorrow, Friday morning. Time marches on.
Again next Thursday night at 8 o'clock Eastern Standard Time, the March of Time. This is the National Broadcasting Company.